have khushu, which is humility and awe of God, in your heart, so that the limbs will be humble too. In another instance, Imam Ali alayhi salam warns of praying whilst tired or sleepy. He states, if you're praying and your eyes are sleepy, stop the prayer and go to sleep. For if you actually continue, you don't know whether you're praying for yourself or against yourself. Number six, the unnecessary delay. Quoting an ayah from the Holy Quran, chapter 74, verses 42 and 43, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us how some of the inhabitants of hell are asked why they're being punished, actually answer, we were not of those who prayed. Imam Ali alayhi salam strongly encourages the respecting of the prayer by performing it at its time and not unnecessarily delaying it or in fact missing it. In another narration, he states, it has been prescribed by the Almighty at these times for a specific reason, so don't neglect it. Number seven, understanding the actions.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This show brings reports from all over the world on Zionist efforts to stamp out criticism of its occupation of Palestine. Today, we look at the murky activities of a little-known tech company called Proofpoint. As a result of acquiring several Israeli companies, Proofpoint appears to have a suspiciously close relationship with the Zionist regime. Later in the show, we'll look at how this company has involved itself in propaganda, which includes attacks on Palestinians and their supporters. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi explaining how Proofpoint transformed from a US tech company into a vehicle for ex-Israeli intelligence operatives.
Is Israel using cybersecurity company Proofpoint to spy on key US media companies? The US company, which filters the emails of journalists at The Washington Post and CNN, has subsumed three different companies, which were set up by alumni at the Israeli military's infamous Unit 8200 intelligence department that surveils Palestinian electronic communication. It also appears that the company has provided email filtering services for SOAS University, University College London, and other British and US educational institutions. The cybersecurity firm currently has four floors containing 200 employees in the Azraeli Center, directly next door to the Israeli Ministries of Defense and Intelligence in the temporary entity. are these employees, many of whom worked in key jobs in the Israeli regime, filtering the emails of students, academics and journalists in the US and the UK? If so, can that information be considered safe? The first company was FireLayers, an Israeli startup fully funded by seed fund investor YL Ventures, which has the key aim of funding Israeli military personnel in starting tech companies. FireLayers was founded by Yair Greinlinger and Doron Algrassi, both veterans of Israel's tech unit. When he was asked if his time in the military contributed to his work with FireLayers, Greinlinger responded, "It has been a while since then, and I am still in the game." FireLayers attended a special invite-only conference funded by the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence just a year before it was subsumed into Proofpoint. The second company of suspicion which Proofpoint has subsumed is Meta Networks. It was founded by Alon Horowitz, a former officer in the Israeli military's engineering corps, a highly sensitive position which he says required taking a polygraph test every couple of years. Meta Networks also employed many other key figures from Israeli military and intelligence bodies. The third troubling company which has been subsumed by Proofpoint is Observit. The startup founded by Gabi Friedlander and Avi Amos has a research and development center in Tel Aviv. It also employs staff from the Israeli military and intelligence. The revolving door also runs in the opposite direction. Yuri Chotzen went from working for Observit for a year to being employed by Israeli intelligence for 3 years. The absorption of these companies has led to an influx of former Israeli military personnel into Proofpoint. However, military is not the only background. Proofpoint's current senior HR business partner is Noam Korotkisalov, who was previously employed for 6 years doing an undisclosed job at the Israeli Prime Minister's office.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert David Miller, who joins us today via Skype from Bristol. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of a lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. I'm pleased to say that we're also joined in the studio today by Loki. Loki is a British-Iraqi rapper and a political activist. He's a patron of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and he's been very active in demanding justice and accountability for the victims and survivors of the Grenfell disaster. Welcome to the show. Loki, let me start with you. And you were one of the first, weren't you, to expose a Proofpoint in a recently published investigation. So we've got mainstream journalists who are apparently having their emails filtered by this company. I mean, journalists at mainstream media outlets. I mean, can you just tell our viewers what the significance of that is?
Well, firstly, it's important to establish that Proofpoint subsumed three different organisations that have a revolving door relationship with Israeli military and intelligence institutions. They are FireLayers, Meta Networks and Observit. Now, off the back of that, Proofpoint has not only opened an office in the Azraeli Center, which is next door to the Israeli Ministries of Intelligence and Defense, but also in addition to that, Proofpoint has been involved in a push to really discredit and target not only Palestinian resistance but also Iran with allegations of hacking. Prior to the acquisition by Proofpoint of these three companies, you did not see Proofpoint publishing reports of this nature. But overall, this is symptomatic of a policy that, according to an article in Calculus Tech, which has states clearly that it passed the Israeli military censor. This was a policy from 2012 of the Netanyahu regime to move employees from Israeli military intelligence into private companies and, in fact, use private companies to function like Israeli intelligence. So we get to a point where we cannot tell where Israeli intelligence begins and private companies end, and vice versa. So it's really a manifestation of a very, very important policy which we need to cultivate a criticality around.
Yeah. I mean, David, it also appears that the company is filtering emails at UK universities. I mean, do you see that as a problem?
Well, this is a very, very strange story, isn't it? This is a tech company which apparently gives, you know, some kind of neutral technological service to universities, media institutions. And yet it has these strange connections with Israeli intelligence and military personnel or ex-personnel. I mean, one of the things which raises an issue here is that, you know, where is this data going? What are they doing with it? How are they using data which they've got access to? And is it safe? Is it data which they're keeping simply for business purposes? Or is any of this leaching out to the Israeli intelligence services? That's the question I would ask.
I mean, Loki, now that Proofpoint's acquired these companies, can you explain what the connection is with the Israeli military and intelligence and why that's problematic? I mean, you did say that they're kind of located right next door. I mean, just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, specifically, when we look at an organization like FireLayers, FireLayers was started by two veterans of the Israeli tech unit in the Israeli military, but also just a year before FireLayers was acquired by Proofpoint, FireLayers attended an invitation-only conference from the Institute for National Security Studies, which is led by former Israeli intelligence figures. And the conference itself was actually funded by several Israeli government ministries, including the Ministry of Intelligence. It was described as a synergetic hub through which ties could be built between private and public companies, between Israel and the United States. In addition to that, you have Meta Networks, which was founded by Alan Horowitz, who, as was said in the report, had such a high-ranking position within the Israeli military that he had to take a polygraph test every few years. So what's clear is that these organizations, and the important point to make here, is that their employees became employees of Proofpoint. There's not an arm's length relationship between Proofpoint and these companies. They were subsumed fully into Proofpoint. So when Proofpoint delivers email filtering services to an outlet like the Washington Post or CNN, who, by the way, both of them have recently published work around the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, for example, CNN, concluding late, though it was, that it's most likely that the Israeli military killed Shireen Abu Akleh. When those emails are going back and forth, who is having access to them? That is the key question here.
No, indeed. And David, I mean, we regularly discuss the Israel occupation forces and the intelligence services on this show, don't we? And I get the feeling that these are much more active in society than we might have imagined. I mean, is that true?
Well, I think that I myself as being rarely shocked when I come across Western intelligence agencies active in some nefarious doings. But the fact that they are involved in even apparently neutral tech companies is quite stunning, really, isn't it? I mean, there seems to be Israeli intelligence, and indeed the intelligence agencies of other Western countries, the US, the UK and others, involved in very, very many areas of life which you wouldn't think were the activities of intelligence agencies, in companies, in private companies, in civil society groups and charities. And it's really much more extensive as an area of activity than perhaps we think of. Maybe we have seen James Bond films when we were younger, or we've read the stuff about the intelligence services, the history of the CIA or MI6 and MI5 and Mossad. But the expansion of the intelligence agencies into almost all areas of life, I think, is something really quite remarkable and seems to have been accomplished much more intensively in the last decade or so.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, Loki, that the Israeli government, you know, seems to be, you know, as it were, arm's lengthing, you know, privatising almost their sort of intelligence operations, if
you know, what you're saying about these companies is correct. I mean, what's going on? I mean, is this to sort of, as it were, avoid, you know, blame, responsibility, culpability for some of the nefarious activities that these organisations are getting up to on their behalf?
So it's been specific policy since 2012. You've had the founding in what they call Beersheba, a cyber tech unit which exists directly alongside Unit 8200. It's important for us to clarify what Unit 8200 is. It's the signals intelligence unit in the IDF, founded in the 50s, over 1,500 members of it. But what it focuses on doing is surveilling the electronic communication of Palestinians. It's been referred to as Israel's big brother. There have been whistleblowers within it and alumni of it that have come out and signed a letter saying what they are doing is using information to blackmail Palestinians into collaboration. It's sort of an omnipotent surveillance entity which is formed around the occupation, and it buttresses that physical seizing of the land. It's the seizing of information. And so this is the unit from which so much of this comes. And I'm sure we'll get into in a moment some of the other organizations that have serious question marks around them, especially when you take into account the history of Israeli spying on the United States specifically.
I mean, just finally, before we go to the next VT, it was interesting, wasn't it? I think it was last year that the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, appointed a former 8200 operative to head up the Labour Party's social media activities. I don't know if you've got any thoughts about that.
Precisely, and Asaf Kaplan's supposed function within the Labour Party is social listening. Now, in the context of Labour functioning as an internal surveillance system, which disqualifies people from political subjectivity, yes, in this country, what is the significance of us having somebody directly coming from Unit 8200 and being there to essentially police the social media profiles of possible members of the party and others?
Indeed. Interesting question. But we'll pause there for a moment because I want to just have a look at this report on how Proofpoint got involved in using its access to client data to engage in propaganda against Palestinians.
Prior to subsuming these three Israeli startups, US company Proofpoint had no history of spotting hacks allegedly linked to the Islamic Republic of Iran or the Palestinian resistance. But since the acquisitions, the company has taken a special interest in this subject.
Iran has been of special interest because of the tensions in the Middle East that have risen over the past several months. When Proofpoint talks about APT actors, what we mean is advanced persistent threat actors. State-sponsored APT actors typically have the backing and financial resources of a nation state, meaning they have access to the most advanced tools. What's really important for organizations to understand about Iranian APT threat groups is that they are incredibly sophisticated and they have a long history of attacking targets in the United States and in their own backyard in the Middle East. The Iranian actors that we track have lots of specific trademarks that allow us to attribute their activity.
Proofpoint has also sought to blame the besieged people of Gaza by reporting on what it claims is Palestinian-aligned espionage. The Proofpoint report into supposed Palestinian hacking was written by former German government employee Konstantin Klinger and former FBI agent Joshua Miller, who is simultaneously a Proofpoint researcher and a reserve captain in the US military. Another Proofpoint report targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran was authored by former BAE Systems employee Michael Raggi and Krista Gehring, herself a former employee of the CIA. An additional report on supposed Palestinian hacking was co-authored by someone who went from working as a journalist for CNN to working for Proofpoint, Selena Larson. She's also a fellow of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, which features John M. Deutsch, the former director of the CIA, on its board. It seems doubtful that a company full of former Israeli spies and current reserves in the U.S. Army can be taken as a neutral authority on these matters.
David, this is all very murky, isn't it? I mean, this company acquires Israel-based firms with strong intelligence connections. Then it starts leveraging its access to client data to produce what appears to be uncheckable stories about alleged Iranian and Palestinian hacking operations. I mean, what do you make of this?
Well, it's an extraordinary part of the story. I mean, the stuff we've talked about already about its involvement with Israeli intelligence is worrying enough. But the fact that they're now leveraging the information that they're getting from clients for by whatever means to push pro-Israel propaganda stories, which have a clearly very little basis in fact, is extremely worrying. I mean, this is the point. This is not just surveillance and the use of surveillance and the outsourcing of surveillance to private companies on behalf of Israeli intelligence. It's also the weaponization of that information to intimidate and to try and force individuals into particular courses of action. It's a propaganda operation, and it's much more than just surveillance as we currently think of it. It's about actually intervening in the society and trying to influence it.
I mean, I wonder, Loki, whether we could pick up on the point that you were talking about this unit H200 and elaborate a little bit more. I mean, it's an obscure intelligence agency, isn't it? I mean, just say a little bit more about that, because people, I think, will be interested to find out.
Well, I think the key thing to understand here is that in terms of the people that do the cybersecurity for Lockheed Martin, the people that do the cybersecurity for Leidos, the people that do the cybersecurity for several Department of Defense classified databases, the companies were founded by former members of Unit 8200. Of course, the article that I mentioned in Calculus Tech, which passed through the Israeli military censor, made clear that Blackcube, for example, was set up to function in this way by former Unit 8200 people. When we look at the company that does the cybersecurity for the Lockheed Martin and Leidos stuff, it's Cyber Reason. Now, Cyber Reason, again, was set up by former Unit 8200 people. The CEO of Cyber Reason actually said in an interview in TechCrunch that his work in Cyber Reason was a continuation of his work in Unit 8200. Now, just when we take into account Lockheed Martin is key US defense contractor. It carried out the census in this country in 2010, 2011. Leidos also had involvement in the census more recently. But if we think historically from Robert Maxwell pushing the Promise software into the United States to be used essentially for Israel to spy on its nuclear development in the US. Also, we have the example of Jonathan Pollard placing a backdoor in US computer systems in order for it to be used by Israeli intelligence. When we also take into account that even the White House, Bill Clinton's phone line was tapped by Israeli intelligence in the 90s, which gave them pre-knowledge of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, what you're talking about is the number one entity which spies on the United States now having access through Cyber Reason to several very important, potentially having access to several very important classified databases. For example, with the pandemic, you saw the setting up of the Cyber Threat Intelligence League, which was founded by Ohad Zeidenberg, again, a former Unit 8200 member. Now, this gentleman simultaneously works for an organization which is funded by the Israeli regime. And also, what you have to understand about the Cyber Threat Intelligence League is it offered pro bono cybersecurity to places of importance in the United States, like nuclear plants, chemical reactors, dams, hospitals, the health service. And in many cases, it was granted that access to deliver pro bono, free of charge cyber security. Now, were this any other entity, were this any other intelligence organization that had this type of umbilical like role with these companies, there is no way that you would see this level of access to information, certainly not in the United States.
No, indeed. Well, from what you're saying, it sounds kind of almost ubiquitous Israeli intelligence operation throughout the globe. But David, let me come to you. I mean, these stories remind me a bit about the widespread claims of Russian hacking and Russian disinformation. Is there a parallel, do you think, with this?
Very much so. I mean, this whole idea that our enemies are engaged in hacking and hack and leak operations, as it's been said in the UK in recent weeks, or that they are engaged in disinformation. There are, it's a huge disinformation industry which now exists to point out alleged Russian or Chinese disinformation. And almost all of it, practically all of it, is actually funded by Western defence and security interests. It's actually about distracting attention from the actual disinformation which is pushed out by Western governments. And it's the same with the Israelis. There are Israeli-backed disinformation monitors in this country as well. And this operation here to try and direct attention to Palestinian espionage or to the Iranians' alleged role. This is the same kind of thing. It's the same playbook that's being used in this country, for example, with the recent Masongate story, where a British journalist, left-wing journalist, Paul Mason, was engaged in the direct communications with MI6 to suggest that they should target rogue left academics who might be critical of the government's policy on Ukraine. And of course, the way in which those kinds of ideas come out about these rogue academics, these are coming directly from not Putin talking points, but MI6 talking points. Who, and we actually see now that these talking points exist, that in this case, the handler for Paul Mason, a guy called Andy Price, actually sends by email to his contacts a list of things he'd like to push out. And that's all the latest stories on, for example, on Ukraine or in previous cases on Russia, Russia's alleged disinformation or Russia's actions. So much of what we see in the mainstream press, like these hacker stories from Proofpoint, is actually talking points from the intelligence services of Israel, the US and the UK.
Well, I mean, these are very troubling accusations, for sure, aren't they? And I wonder, Loki, whether you might be able to say a bit more and perhaps maybe give us some other examples of companies that are perhaps engaged in similar activities. I mean, are there other companies engaged in similar activities like this?
Well, so, for example, we have had one of the most glaring examples recently, which has not been seized upon, unfortunately, by many of us and also the media at all. You know, the NSO group pushing this Pegasus spyware across the planet, claiming that it has no access to the information that is gleaned from these devices through the Pegasus spyware. On top of that, you have British Gas actually investing its employees' pensions into the NSO group's stuff. You had key figures in British civil society, thousands of journalists, human rights defenders across the planet having their phones hacked by Pegasus spyware. And I think the key thing to understand is that actually NSO Group, rather than being distant from the Israeli government, as some tried to depict it in the beginning, it's actually been revealed to be an arm of the Israeli regime. And so here we see this massive, as you say, ubiquitous network of surveillance infrastructure, which is essentially about the war over data. And I think very much so, the data war is actually bigger than the physical war for on land. And so we really have to cultivate a criticality about this among supporters of Palestinian rights.
Indeed. Well, I'm sure it's a topic that we will return to on this show. Thanks for joining us today, Loki, and thank you to David, who joined us from Bristol today because of the rail strike. I wasn't able to be in the studio with me as normal, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now, as unfortunately we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is struggling to defuse a row arising from his insistence that he would remain in office until the 2030s. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Peter Walker and Andrew Sparrow. The piece is titled, Johnson Says His Government is Exceptional as he tries to calm Tory MPs. Boris Johnson claimed on Sunday, 26th of June, that the record of his government was remarkable and quite exceptional, as he continued to brush aside internal Tory criticism of his leadership. However, in a series of interviews at the G7 summit in Germany, Prime Minister Boris Johnson sought to defuse the row triggered by his declaration that he wanted to remain in office until the 2030s, by saying he meant he was focused on his reform agenda. Coming after two huge by-election defeats, revived talk in the Conservative Party of Boris Johnson being forced out of office within weeks or months, the Prime Minister's comment about already planning a third term in office prompted claims he was delusional. As he was leaving the Commonwealth Summit in Rwanda on Saturday, 25th of June, Johnson was asked if he intended to serve a second full term in office upon winning a general election, taking him to 2028 or 2029. Boris Johnson replied, "At the moment, I'm thinking actively about the third term in office and, you know, what could happen then, but I will review that when I get to it." Asked what he meant by leaving after a third term, Boris Johnson said that would mean staying in office until the mid-2030s. Number 10 Downing Street initially suggested that Johnson might have been joking, but on Sunday morning, the Prime Minister said he was making a point about being focused on the long-term challenges facing the country. "What I'm saying is this, is a government that is getting on with delivering for the people of this country, and we've got a huge amount to do," he told reporters at the G7 summit in Germany. Johnson was even more bullish in a subsequent interview with ITV News. When it was put to him that the Conservatives lost the by-elections in Wakefield and in Tiverton and Honiton because voters had lost trust in him and that this should be a source of shame, Boris Johnson replied, "No, because I think if you actually look at what this government is doing, it's pretty remarkable and it's quite exceptional." Attributing the by-election defeats to the decision by the media to focus more on his personal conduct rather than on his policies, Boris Johnson went on, "If you want to look at examples of my leadership, then I would point to you to what we did to solve the Brexit problem, which was very, very tough. What we did was make sure we had the fastest vaccine rollout in Europe, and what we're doing now to help people through a tough time." Meanwhile, the Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis has told the BBC that it was a good thing that the Prime Minister was talking about a third term in office because it meant he was thinking about long-term challenges. In his ITV interview, Boris Johnson also refused to deny a report in The Times saying that he had discussed getting a Tory donor, Lord Brownlow, to fund the construction of a £150,000 treehouse at Chequers to be used by his son, Wilf. According to the Times, the plan was dropped after the police raised security concerns. Asked about the story, Boris Johnson said, "There is no such structure." Asked if he had discussed getting a treehouse built, he said, "All sorts of allegations had been made about his family in the past, and he never discussed them." MPs opposed to Boris Johnson are planning to use the forthcoming elections to the Conservative 1922 Committee to continue effort to unseat him. If a majority of anti-Johnson MPs are elected to the executive of the 1922 Committee, they could remove the current rule preventing another vote of no confidence before June of 2023. Over the weekend, Tory MPs urged cabinet ministers to be more robust in their opposition to Boris Johnson. Tim Loughton, a former minister, told Times Radio that he wanted to see more of them stand up to the Prime Minister. "What I want to see in the cabinet is more ministers prepared to say, 'Are you mad, Boris, if you're thinking about doing that?'" he said. Damien Green, who was de facto Deputy Prime Minister under Theresa May, went further, using an article in the Sunday Telegraph to urge them to mobilise against Boris Johnson. "It is not a secret that a significant proportion of the cabinet think they could do a better job of leading the country than the current incumbent," he wrote. "Now would be a good time to demonstrate those leadership qualities." But a report claiming that up to 6 Conservative backbenchers were considering defecting to the opposition was dismissed by a senior Labour source. "There are a lot of disgruntled people out there, and it is true that bits of conversation are going on," he said. "But that does not mean that people are ready to jump ship."
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Arab ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish
the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad hosts this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, you know, we are talking about the jurisprudential rules of Hajj according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me ask you this question, which is very important, in fact. What are the prohibitions of ihram? What are the things that, in fact, that a pilgrim should be wise of, you know, or about, or conscious of when it comes to ihram? What are the things that he's not, you know, allowed to do, or she's not allowed to do?
That's a very important question, and also, and perhaps it could be the most important question related to
Hajj.
Hajj.
Mm.
Of course, if I am to answer this question, I need to go into detail because there are many, many things that are forbidden for a person who is wearing the ihram of Hajj,
mm-hmm.
and who is actually prepared already to perform the Hajj. There are many things that a pilgrim must not do. The first thing which is not permissible to do is hunting. Of course, hunting this time around is not possible because there's no deer or anything like that to be hunted. Okay?
Yeah, of course.
So it is out of question. Maybe
in the past, people used to do that, but now people are not hunters.
Yeah, you're right. If a person is wearing the ihram and he goes to Arafat or maybe to Muzdalifah, and if there is an animal to be hunted, so he must be very much wary of and must not hunt. This mm-hmm. is the first one.
Yes.
And then we have the second one, sexual intercourse. Physical intimacy is forbidden. It's not permissible for a person who is in this state of ihram, whether he is performing umrah or whether he is performing hajj tamattu, to engage in any sexual activity. And it does not make any difference whether a person is willing to perform, engage in sexual activity with his own wife or maybe with someone else, with another woman, okay? And both of these practices are forbidden. Right. And then kissing a woman, kissing is not permissible. It will make kafara or penalty liable. He will be liable.
Doesn't it render the Hajj void?
No, it doesn't.
It does have an atonement attached.
There is a kafara because you're not supposed to do the Hajj all over again.
Right.
You will have to give a kafara. And of course, in most cases, in all of these cases, a person has to slaughter a sheep. Okay,
for each
error that he commits, and these prohibitions. I mean, these prohibitions. If he happens to commit one of these prohibited acts, he will have to slaughter a sheep as a penalty.
I see.
So number two was sexual intercourse, and number three is kissing a woman, and then touching a woman is also not permissible. Okay, if you are, for example, accompanied by your wife, or you are accompanying your wife and you are together, if you want to touch her without lustful intention, there's no problem. For example, you can be together in the same tent or the same room, and if you happen to touch her without lustful intention, there's no objection to you. But if you touch her with lustful intention and you are wearing the ihram, it is forbidden, and you cannot do it. So then we have number five, looking at a woman and flirting with her. Looking at a woman and flirting with her. It's not permissible to look at a woman with lustful intention as long as you're wearing the, even if you are not wearing ihram, and if you are not performing Hajj, it's not permissible to flirt with a non-mahram woman and to actually look at a woman with lustful intention.
All right.
But the consequence of doing so, doing this act for a pilgrim is a penalty. That is the
atonement.
The atonement. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Let's take a short break, Sheikh Tawheed, if you agree, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the Hajj jurisprudential rules according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Tawheed, we are talking about, shedding some light on the prohibitions of ihram. Would you please continue that?
Yeah. Number one, as I said, hunting. Number two, sexual intercourse. And number three, kissing a woman. Number four, touching a woman. Five, looking at a woman and flirting with her. And then six, masturbation. Masturbation is haram, regardless of whether you are performing Hajj or you're not performing Hajj. It is absolutely forbidden. God forbid if a person commits masturbation whilst he is wearing ihram, he should atone for it.
Right.
And number seven is reciting nikah. Okay. You are wearing ihram, you cannot recite nikah. You cannot, solemnize the marriage contract.
I see.
Whether you want to do it for yourself or you want to do it for someone
else.
For a third party, it is not permissible to solemnize it or to recite the marriage contract.
I see.
And then number eight is use of scent or perfume. It is not permissible to wear perfume, and it's not permissible to use anything which which is fragrant. Like, for example, if you want to use soap and that soap has unnatural fragrance, mm-hmm. you know, it's not permissible to use it.
I see.
And you cannot use something which, for example, any kind of vegetable or something that has fragrant, you cannot use it. And you should make you sure that you avoid things which are fragrant.
I see.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.